Please help me to open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. They may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting for our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve something. This is a speaker meeting. Eric will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Jill, who will share her experience, strength, and hope. I'd like to introduce Eric.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic. It is good to be here. I like coming to this meeting, so I know some faces, I know some names. And did I ever say I'm an alcoholic? I am. Let's see. I first got introduced to AA in July of 2006, I believe, through a treatment program. I was going for 14 days, and then I decided to do 30 days, or 28, whatever it was. And they took us to a couple of AA meetings. I took some suggestions back then. And I got into sober living, and I went to AA meetings because that was a part of that. Anyway, that was my introduction to AA. My sobriety date is June 3rd of last year, so 16 months or so. And it's been a great 16 months. I just got off the phone with a guy who... Well, let me read this, because I'm kind of scatterbrained, and I find that if I read something inside the book, it usually helps, especially if I'm talking to a sponsee. It's easier to go to the book. Anyway, this is a little bit in There's a Solution at the bottom of page 19, which stuck out to me and is a very short way to sum up some of the program. Most of us sense the real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respect for their opinions and our attitudes, which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So, my life depends on trying to think of other people. Not my natural state of mind. Right now, my natural state is, when is this going to be over? Which is kind of similar to how I always feel about a lot of things, whether it's work. When I'm drinking, it's just, when can I get this thing to get that bottle? And, never really achieving a sense of now and being in the present. But the reason I also think about that, I was on the phone with a guy I've been calling, some people that are having trouble staying in the rooms and who I don't see sometimes, like three people. But one person is actually calling back and answering the phone occasionally, but he's just having trouble staying sober, a couple days here and then hiding out. And last night I was talking to him and he was drinking and he said, why did you call me? And I was like, well, to be helpful. And, but it's really that phrase, I don't really know the guy that well. We spent some time together. There is some self in that, in wanting to do it. But, I just want to see the guy sober, I'm having a great time in sobriety. It seems pretty level and balanced a lot of days. And then when it peaks, it's really exciting, I get to move into my own place, something I've wanted for over a year now. And, I'm 38. It's not like I haven't lived alone before, but I'm excited about it. And of course, I got excited, and the next day I overslept and was late to work and felt just behind the entire day, Told my boss at the end of the day, I was like, I hate waking up. He's like, yeah, me too. So I was like comforted, but it wasn't until the day was over. Because I felt like I was making mistakes then from there on out. And, you know, reminding myself with little bits and pieces from the program kind of helped me get through, but it didn't really, like, relieve me, you know, not until I was done. So I have an initial day of introduction to AA where a seed was planted, and I went to AA for about a year and a half, and I know this because I had an 18-month chip. And at some point, I moved to Castro Valley. I'm originally from Oakland, and this is where I used to go to the old Rockridge Fellowship on Broadway, and I knew a couple people, like maybe two. And I had sober living, so I knew some people there who were also trying to stay sober. Eventually, I just got the relationship back that I wanted. And when I moved out of the area, I decided, you know, I don't really want to go to an AA meeting in Castro Valley. I'm feeling sober. Things are progressing. I didn't have a drink for about two more years. Somewhere in that time, I started smoking weed again and working a lot of night shifts, restaurant, clubs, stuff like that. And the drink was only inevitable because once that relationship... Once she moved out because of no thorough self-examination of my day-to-day life, I really couldn't see other people. It was about 2 months, and I just decided to, you know, get drunk. That was my decision. I just wanted to drink the whiskey that I loved and get obliterated. It wasn't an experiment in one drink. It was, you know, it was a couple of years removed from the language that we share in here, which is, you know, a language of recovery, a language of hope, a language of love. And, you know, by and large, I'm not a spiteful, mean person. I'm not these things, but I have a lot of judgment always going on inside my brain, in between my ears. And, you know, I feel, someone put it really well in a meeting once, that I could have related to. I felt like these things were, like, I should feel this way. Can't remember the word. But, you know, that all crept in, and I drank. And I drank for 3 years very hard and had all the same consequences, extended even more, you know, another DUI. And none of that really did anything for me to stop drinking. And at my end, I was drinking, like, just whiskey every day, and I couldn't work because the physical ramifications of drinking were too great to be able to hold a job or go to an interview. I have to be drunk if I wanted to write down something, or, you know, I'd be trembling and shaking, you know. And so I would generally opt for the whiskey instead of the interview because I wanted to alleviate what was going on physically. And all this while, I also had copies of the Big Book and 12 and 12 laying right next to my bed that had been set up in the room since the day I moved in. It's like I couldn't see them. I couldn't open them. I eventually did come back, and a miraculous thing happened. The first day I came back, I went to the 6 a.m. meeting at Rockridge, which became my home group, and I went to that meeting a lot during my first 6 months. Because it was like, well, I woke up, I better go get a meeting first. I used to drink at this time. You know, I was drinking about a fifth of whiskey a day or so, spread out in little the plastic pints of Ancient Age that you can conceal anywhere on your body. And, you know, if I went to a bar, I'd have my whiskey. And if I went for a walk, I'd have my whiskey. If I went to eat, I'd have my whiskey, you know. When I went to DUI class, after I'd come out, I'd go to the bathroom and drink my whiskey. And, you know, I drank on side streets, under bridges, and in bar bathrooms, and anywhere, well, bar bathrooms too, but anywhere I could conceal it and hide and not be seen, yet still try to seem like I'm part of life. And a miraculous thing, I did not have an obsession to drink, you know, from that first meeting. And a lot of the memories of that seed really just, like, opened up. And the one thing that's been very important for me in these last 16 months has always been some of the things that I realized I wasn't participating in, which was fellowshipping with other alcoholics, doing uncomfortable things, doing things that I don't I don't think about, you know, that I don't have the idea to do. So, like, you know, suggestions, whoever they come from, whether they're directed at me at a meeting, I believe that all the suggestions are put out there by anybody who shares. And it's my job to listen and maybe take some of those. You know, it's not just my sponsor saying, you do this. I think there's a lot of great things said by everyone in these rooms. But the one thing that has helped me the most was always was going up to someone who's got in the same position as me, you know, in that first 30 days, or someone who's always in their first 30 days, and going up and just trying to strike up a conversation and make them feel a part, because I needed to feel a part of this thing for it to start having an effect on me. And, you know, it's been working. Every time I kind of get to a little, like, I'm not working on my step work, I would be like, oh, well, I'm not actually talking to anyone who's new either, so let's go do that. And I watch people that have 30 years of sobriety, and I see them talking to people that are new, and I'm like, why are they talking to the new people? You know, how did they get them so quickly to come and start doing, you know, coffee here at this meeting? Or how are they dragging these newcomers along? You know, how did they win their confidence so quickly? I'm like, you know, there's a lot of people with 30 years that come to the meetings, and there's a lot of people that are 30 days or less that come. And sometimes you see them, I see them together, and I'm like, well, I guess that looks like a suggestion that I can do. But it's always given me great sense of purpose and usefulness when I do, you know, have someone who's less than 30 days and I can keep in contact with them. And sometimes they're, you know, they're doing well. It's amazing. And, you know, my sobriety is the most important thing, and I have to continually remind myself. So I'm glad to be here. And thanks, Mindy, for asking me to share.
I'm Jill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jill.
So one of the first things I learned in AA from my first sponsor was when introducing myself, I don't just say my first name and then the word alcoholic. I don't say Jill Alcoholic. I say I am an alcoholic. And every day when I say I am an alcoholic, it makes it more real than just saying my name next to the word alcoholic. So my name's Jill, and I am an alcoholic. That means I have alcoholism, and what that means to me is that I primarily enjoy the taste of alcohol and the effect it has on me. And because of that enjoyment, I did not notice that I also had an allergy of the body, which once I started drinking alcohol, I would just go to any length to get it. And I didn't notice that because, you know, I started drinking just really for my background, it was just the normal thing to start drinking at after game parties in high school at somebody's house whose parents were out of town, like, or the neighborhood, the town I grew up in was sort of like in development when we were growing up. When we first moved there, we were the only house in the area. It was like all forest. And then, you know, by the time I left high school, it was entire subdivisions all around. And so a lot of drinking. We had a lot of keg parties in half-built houses, you know, in the woods, at friends' houses, at parks, you know. It was just regular. It wasn't really a big deal. So I didn't know that I had an allergy of the body. I did not know that I was developing an obsession of the mind. I just was, I had arrived. I think I did know that I had arrived at age 16 when I started getting invited to, like, beer parties. Because before that, I was a very strange little kid. And I knew that, too. I was very aware of the fact that I felt very odd and uncomfortable around people. I grew up in a large family on a street with a lot of other children of my age, and I just always felt like I sort of like was not understanding how things worked when it came to people. Like, I would just see people talking to each other and just wonder how they did that. And I would say that my first drug was probably sleep deprivation. So I would just stay up at night by myself and read books. Like that, that would, if I could just stay in my room and read books or just wander around. I have a first grade report card still that I keep. And it says, you know, Jill is a friendly girl, but she spends too much time wandering around aimlessly choosing crayons. Like, aimlessly, like, she made sure she put that on there, just choosing crayons. And I don't even know what that meant. But I do remember, like, being in kindergarten in first grade and just sort of just, like, feeling like an observer and not really a participant in life. And that kind of just stayed. And so started drinking at parties, 16, and discovered very early that I was really fucking good at it. I was so good. I was 88 pounds, and I could put the football players under the table. And I really liked that about myself. I did. I liked it. I thought it was so cool that I had this skill. And so I made a decision early in life to turn the word party from a noun to a verb and just live by that one word motto, party. And so I made all my decisions from like the age of 17 to 37 when I got sober. I made all of my decisions based on will this decision enable me to party like I want, or will this hinder my ability to party? And so one time, God, I forgot I'm a long speaker. I don't have to, oh, shit. I was born in a small town. Okay, so let me back up. I'm sorry, you guys. My sobriety date is August 18th, 2003. I have a sponsor. I got sober in San Francisco. And I got sober with no intention to stay sober. My plan was to stay for 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, and get my looks back and get back to life. And I have had continuous sobriety since that day that I walked into my first meeting. And I don't say that to brag. I honestly have no idea why. I really do feel like it's good fortune and luck. I've met people who have done the steps way better than me, who are dead now from drinking themselves to death, who could recite the book backwards and forwards, who went to daily meetings and ended up dead from drinking. There's been days that I've really, really wanted to drink, and for some reason I didn't drink that day, which is just like the days before I got sober when I really, really didn't want to drink and was just shit-faced 24 hours a day. So it doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't ask why. There's no chapter that says why it works in the book. I've tried to find it. So it's not there. How it works is something I can talk about. But first let me tell you about myself. So I grew up in a very loving, very regular family, middle class. Mom stayed home. Dad went to work as a school teacher. So my parents were home all night, all weekend, and all summer. Which was awesome. My parents are pretty rad. Like, I know people who, like, are always meet my parents and say, I really, you know, how are Joan and Ann? Like, it's like, really? Like, you don't want to know how I am? I didn't want to be in that family, though. I wanted to be in a more exciting family, even though I didn't even know what excitement was when I was 6 or 7. I just knew that I wanted more excitement than I had. And I saw a TV show about a prostitute once before puberty, so I didn't know sex. but I wanted to be a prostitute. She had fancy clothes. She had makeup on, and she did. She had her own apartment. She had a high rise. And she had some guy in her life that beat her up, but that was the only stupid thing she did. I just remember thinking, I'll just be a prostitute without a pimp. Because that's her mistake, right? And I started drinking at 16. At 17, and when I graduated from high school, I had some like horrible consequences where I got caught by my dad, who I really loved and loved then. And he was disappointed. He's a pillar of our community. I shamed him, and I learned a very important lesson to never let that happen again. So I did not ever get caught again. And I never got caught. I had a fake ID by the time I was 17, so I was drinking in bars, which taught me how to drink responsibly. And I lived in cities where I didn't need cars, so I didn't have, because driving drunk was stupid. So I just didn't have a car. And I chose my booze carefully. I drank scotch on the rocks because that way I wouldn't get fat. And I would have no, which was the only adverse side effect from drinking too much that I could ever imagine. I never drank alone, because that's what alcoholics do. Until I decided that grown-ups drank alone. Sign of maturity. I never drank alone in a bar, because that was so alcoholic. Until I decided that sophisticated world travelers like me drank alone in bars. Totally fine. It was a sign of sophistication. My jet-setting life. I never drank in the morning. Until I decided that since I was a world traveler, it was really, even though it was 6 in the morning, I had just gotten home from a long trip, and so for me, it was the end of the day. It was totally okay to drink all morning. To drink absinthe. It's 7 in the morning. Alone. I just remembered that. I used to do that. So I chose a job that I still have. I'm a flight attendant. I dropped out of college to become a flight attendant. I was going to do it for 6 months in 1988. But I realized that it's the perfect party job. The perfect party job. If you're 21 years old and you're living in New York City and you have to work 10 days a month, that leaves a lot of time to party. And I just was like so good at it. I had to, right? And so, like, nothing really happened to me. Is the good news. Nothing happened to me. I lived by that credo that I had established at age 17, which was I don't want any ever to get caught because it's disappointing to people that I loved. And I'll tell you why I didn't want to make my parents feel bad, which is because at 15, my oldest sister had died. And she died suddenly and of a mysterious illness that was not discovered until the autopsy, and it was, she got sick, and 3 weeks later she was dead, and it was devastating to my family. And so I didn't ever want to upset my parents, ever. So I had a really good reason to not make my parents upset. And so I didn't want to do that. So I lived a total double life, down to the wear the conservative outfit out the door and pull it off to display the mini skirt and pull down the fishnets as soon as I get in the car, right? And then just start, like, stealing drugs and... we lit a car on fire once. Like, I was a bad person in a good girl's outfit. I stole vehicles, I stole money, I stole boyfriends, I stole your self-worth, I would steal your clothes, I would steal... I would befriend you and then fuck your boyfriend and then take you out to lunch. You know? Just drunk. I would take all the drugs when you passed out and I would just, I didn't know what happened to them. Nothing happened. I've never been in a car accident. I have wrecked cars by driving them. Like, I burned out a clutch once on the way to a party, and we left the car on the freeway and hitchhiked to the party. But I didn't wreck the car, right? I just ruined the car and just left it for my brother to deal with. I never got a DUI. Because I got an MIP once, which is a minor in possession, in a car. And I just smiled my way right out of the DUI. And then I stopped drinking and driving. I was never hospitalized for an overdose or alcohol poisoning. I tried to get hospitalized a few times near the end, but it didn't work. People would just send me home without the prescription that I had really hoped, that I was really hoping for. And I never lost a marriage. I never lost a job. Nothing happened. I just drank a lot. And on the other hand, nothing happened. Nothing ever happened. You know what I mean? Right? Nothing happened. When I came into AA at the age of 37, I had no friends. I had acquaintances, and I had people I could call to go drink with, but they were so fucking annoying. I would have to pre-drink. I had this friend, Marcy. She lived downstairs. She thought we were friends. She was annoying. Because we would go to the attic on 24th Street in Valencia, and she would order a drink, and then she would just let it sit there. And I would just look at it, and I would look at her, and I would look at her drink, and I would look at her, and I would look at mine, and I would be like, when is she going to take a drink so I can take a drink? It was so annoying. She would just order the one drink. And she was a partier, too. She did all kinds of drugs. She was a Burning Man girl. She met some guy and over at some Burning Man party and, like, married him a month later. And that was in 2002, and they're still married. But she didn't, you know, so she was a wild girl. But she could just drink a drink, and it drove me nuts, so I had to ditch her. Because I would have to pre-drink and then post-drink every time. Because I didn't want her to know that I was an alcoholic at that point. That was near the end, actually. That was near the end of my drinking when I was starting to notice it. But so here I am. I'm in my 20s. I'm in New York City. I'm stealing things and associating with known criminals. And I'm asking you if you want Coke or Sprite during the day. And at night, we are, like, hot rodding through Central Park in stolen car, and during the day I'm asking people on the way to Paris if they want chicken or beef, and it's just like great, nothing's happening. I decided that I needed to leave New York because it was just getting too hectic. I mean, there was too many date rapes that I had lived through, and too many just like horrible memories from this corner or that bar or this person, or it was just like getting bad. But I just thought I needed to have a fresh start. So if you're new, we call that taking a geographical cure. We think moving will make things better. So I moved to California. And I had a total transformation, which is something else I was very good at, which I learned at high school, was this is another superpower that I developed quite early, which was I go into a room or go to a neighborhood, and I could scan it. Partiers, find them. And in this town, they are mountain bikers. So I would go buy a mountain bike. And I would learn all the lingo and what a grommet is, and I would learn about safety brakes, and which is smoking pot on a mountain bike trail, by the way. And I learned everything there was to know about mountain bike partiers, and I would become a mountain bike partier. Or, like, when I moved to San Francisco, the hard partiers in my region turned out to be, like, craft people. So I learned about makers, and I learned about building my own ceiling and stuff like that. Because that's what the hard people I ran into first did. Like, they did stuff like that. So I started to learn how to do stuff like that. In college, like, the first people I came upon that I, like, could sense in my area were these horrible, horrible folk singer-songwriters and their girlfriends. And so I started to love, like, bro rock, you know, like, bro rock. You know what I'm talking about? I'm not going to torture you with explaining it, but it's just, like, it's somewhere between Fish and Big Head Todd. Right? And I just followed that band, and I hung out with their girlfriends, and nobody would date me in the band because I was a fucking mess, but they let me drink with them. And loved that for a while, you know? And so here I am. I land in Mill Valley. I get the bike and start drinking Guinness. And, right? I meet this guy, and, I fell in love for the first time in, ever. And I got pregnant, and we're drinking and riding bikes, and I got pregnant, and he said, "You have to get rid of this baby. If you get rid of this baby, I'll stay with you forever, because I can't be a father." And so I had an abortion, and he, on that same day, he slept with this friend of his. That same day, instead of going with me to the hospital, he went out and got drunk and had sex with some girl. And the only reason I know this is because 2 days later, she came to my house and sat on my couch and told me. And she pretended that she didn't know about me and the guy, right? Because that's what drunks do. Like, she wasn't evil. She's just a messy, stupid, stoner drunk mountain bike chick. Like me. And so, I thought, I need to get out of the scene. I felt like my life was ruined. And I decided that these stupid stoners who drank too much, I had to get away from them. So I moved to the city. And I was at a party, and these were road bike people. They were way more sophisticated. Way healthier. And I met a guy in the blackout, and we went to his place, which is back in Marin, but we did one of those things where we slept together, we woke up, what was your name? Dave, I'm Jill, hi. And we had a relationship for 2.5 years. And Dave was a champion. He could drink a fifth in a sitting, and that really impressed me because he had a nice apartment and money and good job. And so I thought, well, I don't need to get healthy. I just need to learn to drink like Dave because, look, he's got it all, and he can still party. So I sat down and trained myself to drink a fifth in a sitting with Dave. And it just got really, it got really, really ugly. And I got really, really stupid. I mean, when you're that drunk all day and all night, like, you honestly believe the girl who is, has the thick Russian accent and the very scantily skin-tight white with cuts here outfit that's hanging out on your couch with your boyfriend is really is his friend from high school. And and no, it was Vanya. My friend from high school. Barely speak English. Oh, it was a shitty high school. But, you know, so that, we drove that into the ground after 2.5 years, and I just, like, that's the first time in my life, like, I actually really wanted that after the mess with the other guy in Marin. Like, I actually, when I realized what a mess he was, I stayed because I wanted to kill myself. And I thought, this is a really classy way to go. I'm in a nice waterfront condo in Sausalito with Fifth a Day champion by my side, and I'm just going to drink until I die. This is, might as well, right? I'm good at this. And I have no other skills. And at that point, that was in like 2001. And at that point, it had broken through to my consciousness that I was nobody and that I was nothing. Not only had I nothing happen to me, but I was nothing. I knew that there was a shell and that outside was just a chameleon's shell and that I would just be whatever I needed to be in order to drink. I knew that at that point. And so drinking myself to death with this guy might as well be where I do it because it's comfy in this apartment and there's a nice view. And it didn't work. For 2.5 years, I just didn't die, and I just didn't die. And so I decided, I have to leave this guy. I have to really get healthy this time. And when I was started to say, I need to get healthy, that became my mantra, right? I need to get healthy. Because I couldn't say, I need to stop drinking. And so I broke up with that guy, and I met this other guy, and, you know, I did a lot of things, but the mountain biking thing just kind of stuck. It turned out that I kind of liked that. Not only did I like the drinkers that I met through it, but I actually liked doing it. So the bicycles kind of stuck after that. Oh, in New York, I was into boxing for a while. I met this boxer who drank a lot. It's ridiculous. Me with the gloves. There I am, and I meet another guy, and I see this, like, shiny, happy guy go by. And there's some relationships in my story, I apologize. It's not, you know, SLA, but sorry. He's shiny and fit and skinny, and I'm like, okay, that one, he looks so healthy, I'm going to get healthy with that guy. And I manipulated my way into a relationship with him, and I saw him at a bike race, and I was like, that one. And I wasn't even trying to find the drinker this time. I wanted the healthy one. But God damn it, if on our first real date, he didn't hand me a pile of pills and say, you want to take some? I'm a drug addict. He actually said that. I'm a drug addict. He wants some pills. And I just was like, yes! The other one I thought was the champion, but all he did was sit on the couch and drink. But this guy, he's doing, like, not just a job, but, like, athletics. Like, he's a pro. He's a professional-level athlete, and he's a drug addict. Like, this is the one that's going to show me how I can do this. And so that is what we did. We We treated our alcoholism with supplements and exercise. And it worked for a long time, like 6 months. You know. So over the course of 3 years, I would say about 6 months of that was like good, and the rest was just black depressions, like weeks of silence between each other, and disappearances, and sobbing fights. And this is the point where I started to, all that beer, and I had stopped riding my bike because I just hung over too much. And I said, like, the scotch wasn't keeping the weight off anymore. And and I started to gain a lot of weight, and just drinking nothing but alcohol and crying is bad for your looks. And so we left. And I said, I have to have him back. I need to get my looks back. I will go to AA for 3.5 weeks and get my looks back and go get my boyfriend back, who had given me the "you're dead to me" breakup. And so I went to AA, and I walked into a meeting on 24th and Florida, and this is where, I mean, I have to tell the same story because it's the same thing that happened. I mean, it's only one thing happened there, so you've heard it before, I apologize, but it's the same, the only one thing happened there, so I have to tell it the same way. But I walk in the room, and it was all, it's exactly like I knew AA was going to be, which was a coping group full of miserable, sad people in folding chairs, just hunched over, coping with the sorrow of having to be sober. It was a coping group. I knew it, and that's what they looked like. They just looked gray and old, and one guy was sitting like this, and with two guys at the front, a table just like this, and one of them just went on and on and on and on and on about himself forever. And then they started sharing stories about themselves around the room, and I know now that they knew I was a newcomer, the girl in the back sobbing hysterically. Put a 10 in the basket, put a 10 down, because I didn't know anybody. And they told stories about how the first step had worked in their lives. Like, I had a hole inside of me, this man said, and I didn't know who I was, and I feel complete now that I'm sober. And another guy said, you know, my family didn't talk to me. My son wouldn't let me see my grandchildren. And they let me babysit him now, or something along those lines. We hear that story a lot. It's true. It happens. And this guy said that. And what I didn't talk about during my share, which was something else that happened over the years during my drinking, was like nothing was really happening to me. I wasn't having consequences. But alcoholics, I believe, I needed a reason to drink, because I also realized that my life really wasn't that bad. And so I had to come up with hardships in my head. I had to come up with something that justified the "if you had my life, you'd drink like me too" line that I also like to live by. When people would start to like point out my life, I'd be like, well, if you had my life, you'd drink like this too. So I needed a story to back up that belief of myself. And so what I had done was I had decided over a long period of time that it was my parents' fault that my sister had died. And I nurtured and I worked on, I tweaked this belief for years. And I rewrote the history of the events in my mind to prove that they had killed my sister through negligence and bad parenting. And I told myself this story for so long and so carefully and so insidiously that it was true in my mind by the time I was 37. It was true. And so I hated them at this point in my life. Like, not only did it allow me to drink, but the side effect was I began to detest my entire family. And so I forgot that I was just making it up. But I really believed this about my family. And so by the time I walked into that first meeting to get my boyfriend back, I hated everybody in the world, not just people around that couldn't drink like me, but my family, too. Like, I was totally isolated from the world at this point. And this guy said that about his family, reestablishing a relationship. And it sounds so, you know, if you've been around, you've heard the story a lot. Like, oh, my family hated me and I'm in it. But when I heard that for the first time in that meeting in AA, it was like a bag of bricks had just hit me over the head. Like, and I woke up to the reality of my life. I had an awakening at that moment. Like, you hate your family for no reason. It was like, and this guy telling the story made me realize that I didn't have to live that way. It was like, for a split second, I realized that I could change that if I wanted to. And what happened at the end of that hour in that first meeting was that I walked in with one goal in mind: to not drink for 3.5 weeks to get my looks back. I did not walk in there to get sober, because I knew it was impossible. And an hour later, I thought maybe I could stay sober tonight. And that was life-changing. I mean, I didn't realize it at the time. I just thought maybe I can stay sober just one night and go to a meeting tomorrow. Because that's what they told me at the end of the hour. This guy came up to me and he said, you know, there's meetings with people your age and your gender. And he didn't say that, but he said, there's meetings with women. And I'll take you to one tonight. And he took me to, like, a midnight meeting in the marina. That was my first and last meeting in the marina. I guess he thought I belonged there, but I don't have all the permission. I had enough hope to just go to one more meeting that night. And just from hearing those stories that those two guys said, one, I had a hole in my heart. I don't have it anymore. Two, my family hated me. They don't hate me now. I mean, it was just, it just floored me. And just enough to get me to get into this strange guy's truck. This big guy with a blue windbreaker up to his neck, and he had those fat heroin hands. You know those heroin hands that people get? And I just got in his truck, took a book at night in the mission, and... But he, you know what he did? He drove me to the marina, and he dropped me off at a meeting, and he drove away. And then 6 months later, he died of a heroin overdose. But that night, he drove me to the marina, and I met my sponsor. And I have been sober ever since. And what I'll wrap up with is, I know I told the whole drunkalogue, but I love those when I'm new, so. I learned a lot of things over the years, but the most important thing I think I learned was from that first meeting, which was that the meetings are here to give the newcomer hope that they can stay sober for one day. That's what I got, and it's been working for over 11 years. And I keep coming to meetings to get that hope. And I go to see, I see a sponsor so I can learn how to give it to others. And on Monday, I'm moving to Nashville.
Boo!
No. I've known Willis since I got sober. Yeah. And Sham. I've known Sham since I got sober. And some of you I just met this year, like Seth. And I'm really going to miss Oakland. And Mindy, thank you for letting me share. And that's it.
Announcements?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My name is Victor. I'm an alcoholic. When you guys exit, just